Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. It's Wednesday, which means two things. For every Wednesday, it means that Jared Jackson's here.
Well, what do you know?
Legendary producer of the main The Young Turk show, upcoming host of JR Rated, which they just can't seem to get started. But someday we're gonna have that.
I think it's an internal effects going on here. Mm-hmm. I think there's some
politics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a lot of politics at TYT. That's what we do. And actually, both for this Wednesday and for all of this particular Wednesday, it's Juneteenth. It's a holiday to recognize the end of slavery and both the hard path to get to it and the struggles that continued after it was technically gone. But we also here at TYT are going to have a special that you're going to be taking part in.
Yeah. Yeah, so later on today, we might have to go with Pacific time since you guys know we're on the West Coast. 5 to 7 Pacific time, we're going to be doing a Juneteenth special. We'll have guests come in, but mainly it'll be myself, Brooke Thomas, as you all love. And also Adrian Lawrence will be hosting with us. We'll talk about the history of Juneteenth. We'll talk about how its effects on our modern American culture. And honestly, we'll probably fill in a lot of people on what it is in the first place. Because just from a tweet this morning and an Instagram post this morning, I've had a couple of people say, wow, never even heard of it.
Actually, while I was doing some reading up on it.
And it's not a failure of those people. It's a failure of our education system and our history of our country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the many things that we just don't teach.
Yeah.
I think, Brooke and I were talking before the show about a couple like really significant historical events that even in like the state where it happened, they don't teach the kids. There will be some history there. By the way, from 5 to 6:30 Pacific, it's going to be available for everyone, the normal place and all that. But it's going to be uninterrupted and in its entirety for members from 5 to 7. So if you're not already a member of the Young Turks, you can go to tyt.com/John to get membership. We've got a million things to get to. I will clue you in to use all that stuff a little bit later on. Let's just jump into the first topic. Donald Trump was asked recently on what he thinks about the Central Park Five and if he has any regrets for the way that he addressed that incident back in the very late 80s. Here is what he said when April Ryan brought it up.
April. Mr. President, will you apologize to Central Park Five? They've been exonerated. There have been videos and movies shown about the case, and you came out with a full-page ad saying that they should die. They face the death penalty.
Why do you bring that question up now? It's an interesting time to bring it up. You have people on both sides of that. They admitted their guilt. If you look at Linda Fairstein and if you look at some of the prosecutors, they think that the city should never have settled that case. So we'll leave it at that.
So does he regret? No, no regrets whatsoever. He thinks that, yeah, he pretty much nailed it in both sides, okay? There's very bad people on both sides, apparently, he thinks. I guess probably not shocked.
Yeah, he's had multiple opportunities to write. Honestly, it doesn't matter what he says at this point. It won't right the wrong of what he did because we know what he truly believes. So if he actually says the right thing now, which he's incapable of, we know it doesn't actually mean anything. This allowed us a window into his perspective on the world. Because his first question was, why would you bring that up right now? That's odd. Mm-hmm. Having absolutely no idea that there's a documentary that's been put out that everyone is talking about about that case. And even though it's been heavily talked about and discussed throughout the years, there's still issues that came out within that documentary of details that people still didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I haven't watched it yet myself. But the reason I haven't watched it is because I need to be in a certain calm state of mind to watch certain things like that, you know? So whenever you need to be, your emotions have to be in a high, or you need to get stressed out by the way our country and certain things in our society have treated folks, I have to be in a calm state of mind or else it's gonna ruin my whole week. So I haven't watched yet for that reason. He hasn't paid any attention to it because he just doesn't give a damn. Mm-hmm.
They don't play it on Fox News in the morning, so how would he see it?
Right. Yeah.
I felt the same way. My fiance asked if we wanted to watch it, and I was like, it seems like it's gonna be so hard. Let's just watch something a little bit easier. So we watched some old episodes of Black Mirror and got even more stressed out. But anyway, so I do plan on watching it. I guess he doesn't know. I mean, it's a major release. Like, people have been talking about it. And just super fast. I hate this sort of analysis, and I hate people talking about what's dominant behavior, what's alpha behavior, what's not. I only ever bring it up when it's in reference to people that their supporters say is an alpha.
Right.
The way that he said, oh, it's interesting that you bring it up now. Why are you bringing it up now? And then immediately transitions to another thing. That is such a little whiny little way to, like a fake little question that you're not gonna let them respond to. And then you're immediately gonna start talking because you know that your statement doesn't actually stand. I hate that little behavior that he does all the time. But whatever, I'm wrong. He's apparently the big dominant alpha.
So the next time that question's asked, just say, so do you believe in DNA evidence? Do you believe, or do you believe in coerced confessions from teenagers? Which one is it? Is it DNA evidence? Mr. Trump, do you believe in DNA evidence? Yeah. Ask him that first and then see what his answer is. And then after that, say, do you understand that that was the major part of this case?
Well, and I would ask him, what if you had gotten your way back in the day when this case was out there and you decided, I think in 4 newspapers, to put out this ad, bring back the death penalty, bring back our police. Obviously, small text, you're not gonna be able to read it. So let's zoom in on a little section of it. It says, I want to hate these murderers and I always will. I am not looking to psychoanalyze or understand them. I'm looking to punish them. I no longer want to understand their anger. I want them to understand our anger. I want them to be afraid. Yes, he wants them to be afraid, and then he wants them to be murdered by the state. So if he had gotten his way back then, years before it was eventually proven that they did not do what people were saying they did, they would be dead. They would be dead now. Does he regret advocating for the death of people that were shown to be innocent? He doesn't, of course. He thinks they should have been killed whether they did it or not. Because he's so angry. He's not looking to understand. He's looking to express his rage. And he still does that. All these people that he's locking up in concentration camps on the border, some of whom have already died, more of whom will die. Did they break any laws? Did they not break any laws? Do they have a credible claim to asylum or not? None of that matters. He hates these people. He's enraged these people. So if they die, that's really on them.
It's just the way he's operated and everything he's ever done. So also ask him maybe when folks have been exonerated, or maybe you thought your Supreme Court justice that was accused of all these allegations, how unfair people were to them. If you're a person who believes in fairness, you might want to also ask him, why is it when it comes down the line of minorities that are accused unfairly and wrongfully of a crime that you're still looking to kill? Versus white folks that were accused of things that you were completely in defense of them for, why is it that line keeps getting drawn for you?
Yeah.
And maybe you can understand why a significant portion of our population acknowledges your racism.
And I want to give you, we sometimes fill in all the details, sometimes we don't. So I want to make sure that you know this, he has come back time and again to this topic and how much he wishes, even after it had been proven by DNA evidence that they didn't do this, after it was found out exactly who had done it, Matias Reyes, how much he wishes these people had been killed. So he said this is a June 2014 New York Daily News op-ed. My opinion on the settlement of the Central Park jogger case is that it's a disgrace. What about the other people who were brutalized that night in addition to the jogger? Okay, well, what about those people? Do you have any evidence that the people you wish had been murdered by the state committed those crimes? You don't. What he has is a belief that bad things happened here. I want someone to pay. These people were in the area. Most of them were black, so maybe they should have been killed. And when, again, I love that you bring up the sort of people that he thinks deserve the death penalty. He was talking about the Boston bomber. Someone responded, this is back years ago. Someone responded on Twitter, with all due respect, after your rant about the Central Park Five, perhaps you should keep law and order comments to yourself. He responded to them, tell me, what were they doing in the park? Playing checkers? Because of course they weren't playing checkers. They weren't there for some innocent reason. They were black and Hispanic. They were there to rape people. They were there to murder people. Clearly, that drips from the statement there. And you can still see it in practice every day. When there's a terror attack, if it was someone who he believes at the time or is actually Muslim, he will call them a monster. He'll call them an animal. He'll talk about how they need to be killed. If it was someone if it was a white kid who ran into a church and tried to start a race war, mental illness, lone wolf. There's no need for blood in that case.
It's the way it works. He launched his presidential campaign with we need to shut down all immigration only from the southern border until we find out what the hell's going on because they're rapists, they're murderers, they're killers.
Yeah.
That's the basis for everything he's ever done. And that's honestly, that's the reason why he's in office, because enough Americans agree with him.
I agree as well. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back. Technically, I guess his campaign for re-election has been launched. We're gonna show you what exactly happened at that rally after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*****. the Republic or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Said, you know, if we have about 3 or 4 empty seats, the fake news will say headlines. He didn't fill up the arena.
Okay, well, possibly that was on his mind because he apparently did have a little bit of trouble filling up all of the arena, which is fine if you're not a person who's obsessed with attendance. And this is, after all, for Donald Trump, a big event. This was the official relaunch of his campaign. We'll break down whether that's actually true. So I guess I'm part of the fake news, so I have to evaluate if he actually did fill it. So the arena had a capacity of about 20,000. In his speech to supporters at Amway, Trump said that 120,000 people had requested free tickets, which means not only is every seat gonna be filled, like literally every flight I've been on in the last decade, but you're also gonna have tens of thousands of people waiting outside, right? Well, about an hour before he was scheduled to speak, the lines were gone. The overflow area was virtually empty. And in fact, if you take a look at this photo, one of many going around, there's sections, whole sections that have like 2 people hanging out in them. Now, for most politicians, this wouldn't matter, but this is a guy who really cares about being the best and the biggest, and his attendance was bleh. So anyway, official also, relaunch, what do you think?
I also read some stories, and this is the thing. I honestly couldn't care less about the number of people that showed up. Mm-hmm. If 120,000 people did show up, it's actually sad, but
so this is good news.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, it's actually good news for America that they're finally tired of the same song and dance from this guy. So the other part of it is I read there was a report. Okay, I was trying to find the exact report because I was flipping through things this morning about his launch last night, and they said he was busting in people and making sure. I mean, I'm sure they still wanted to be there. I get it, but when you're busting in people to make sure you have those numbers. It again goes to your mentality of I got to make sure I'm on this number point rather than I need to say certain things. Mm-hmm. I need to convince certain people that aren't there. You're still going to be televised. You're still speaking to Americans. So those 120,000 people that were vying for position, if you're just simply speaking to those folks, you're not going to get reelected. You need to speak to the rest of the country. So the fact that his focus is not on that, but instead on how many numbers he can fill in the arena, which he didn't do, says a lot.
Yeah, and look, I'm sort of joking about the official relaunch. That's what he was saying. Mm-hmm. But of course, as was pointed on Twitter, he filed paperwork with the FEC the day he was inaugurated to run for re-election. That was the official launch because that's the actual paperwork. This is really just a rally. We joke that it's the official relaunch or whatever. And honestly, I was expecting, as I alluded to earlier in the week on the Damage Report, that he would do something big. Some big new scary program, you know, like fascism all in your face. We didn't really get that. It was kind of the same pathetic tropes. Like he's still, by the way, running against Hillary Clinton. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
And that's why a couple things that happened in the media really frustrated me around this rally. Politico has a headline right now, "Trump Stages His Greatest Show Yet." No, Trump staged another show of the sort that he does. It would be like if I finish a random episode of the Damage Report, they're like, "The greatest one yet." Nah, it's probably run of the mill. It's probably what we do. And by the way, and this angers me to no end. MSNBC yesterday, if you flicked on at one point, I didn't, but I saw people talking about it on Twitter, empty podium awaiting his speech. Have we learned nothing from 2016?
No.
You don't have to show the rally live, but even if you're gonna show the rally live, how about show the actual rally and not an empty stage, not implying to millions of your voters, most of whom don't support Donald Trump, that this is the most important thing imaginable, that Donald Trump is going to say something, something big.
Actually, I take it back. They did learn something from the last election cycle. They learned that they can make a lot of money off of this no matter what. So they obviously, at this point, for these elements of it, they don't care whether or not they're promoting him to no end. They're like, well, this gets us more money coming in. I mean, when Trump got elected, people told me, and they're like, oh, well, you know what? It sucks that Trump's in, but you know what? It's probably good for you guys. I said, not really, because my brain can't handle the level of stupidity that I have to listen to every day from him. So it's not, they think, oh, it's gonna be great for you guys, because that's all people think about a lot of times. That bottom line of, well, a lot of people watching.
You know, I get what they're saying, but the thing is, for the first, you know, X number of years that I was doing this job, we had Obama. We always found stuff to talk about. There were still problems in the world. And like, we don't shoot in 4K and we don't generally zoom in on my face much, but you can see writ large in the fissures and cracks in my face what effect Donald Trump as president has been. So I think I would take a little bit more Obama for my own personal health. Yeah, and so look, it's another one of the rallies. I just wish that the media would be a little bit more responsible in how they cover it. Like I will watch and I'll read articles breaking down what was said to see, is there something that we need to counter? Is there something that we need to worry about? But you don't just have to show the entirety of the thing. You don't have to support his narrative. Okay, let's turn to a little bit more of what was actually there, because I want to know going into this next election, what do we need to be campaigning based on? What is he going to campaign based on? Donald Trump in his rally last night, he hit a lot of the points that you probably are used to at this point. Take a look at some of what his audience was responding with. Here is one chant. Okay, so you probably, like me, were focusing on the fact that the audience was chanting drain the swamp. But if you watch that again, take a look at his goofy, dumb facial expressions as they're saying that. So when I watched that clip of them chanting drain the swamp, I just thought, like, there's never been a cult in America as strong or as effective. Look at his dumb face. Look at the lips. What was that? What was he kissing? A ghost? I don't know. But anyway, this is not Trump candidate, never been in office, I'm gonna drain the swamp. This is Trump 2 years in. We know what his cabinet has been. We know who he's brought in. Yep. What are you talking? They still think he's going to drain the swamp.
It's really easy. Like every time, talk to a supporter, talk to Trump when everybody has these interviews with him, ask him. Your supporters were chanting drain the swamp. Can you tell us specifically how you've drained the swamp in the past 2 years? Mm-hmm. Just ask him. And let him flounder, or let him come up with a lie that you could then say, hey, so what about all the people you've appointed that have actually filled the swamp even further, have made it overflow?
Yeah, like, did you drain the swamp when you brought in Reince Priebus? Did you drain the swamp when Scott Pruitt was turning the EPA over to the big polluters? Mm-hmm. Like Rex Tillerson, was he draining the swamp? Your new AG is the AG from the 90s. Is that draining the swamp? Where is the drain? I see the swamp, I cover it every day. I don't get the drain at this point.
It's not there.
And I feel bad, like you're not supposed to insult these people. I get it, although they kind of get off on being insulted, so they kind of like it in a weird way. But like you can't help but feel sorry for these people. And not, it's like anyone who's been taken by a con. Mm-hmm. Like you can read books on this. It is incredible. If you know someone in your family who's like gotten taken in by one of these like multi-level marketing things, it is incredibly difficult to break them out. Every time that you point out how it's a scam or whatever is only gonna reinforce for them that they need it to be consistent.
And
so his talking points don't have to be consistent. I wanna show you a clip. He's gonna say two things in the beginning of the clip and the second clip. And I want you to evaluate, is this internally consistent?
Republicans do not believe in socialism. We believe in freedom, and so do you. We will defend Medicare and Social Security for our great seniors. We will defend it like nobody else. And we will always protect patients with pre-existing conditions, always.
Always.
We hate socialism. Man, don't you love Social Security? Oh, Medicaid's great. And the audience is like, yeah, socialism sucks. Yeah, I want my socialism.
Literally,
how do you how
Social
do you
Security,
to these
the first word
is it's social.
Ism.
Oh, God. Okay, and I get it. I get it. The people who go to a Trump rally are not those who were going to try to sway to any candidate. Doesn't matter if it's Biden or Marianne or Bernie. None of them are getting those people. Like, maybe you can get Tiffany or Barron, but none of the others are gonna vote for you, the people who'd show up at that rally. But it's disconcerting as an American, as a human. I just want more, not much more, a little bit more. Man, I grew up watching Star Trek, where they work, they don't even get paid. They just pursue their scientific passions, and they just explore and they learn things. That's what I thought the future would be like. Instead, it's people talking about acid washing emails and crystal clean coal.
You take it out and you clean it. Sorry, you lost me on Star Trek. last thing about that one line with socialism and social security. That wasn't a Trump riff where we're like, oh yeah, Trump is an idiot, and he just went off. That was written.
Yeah.
Someone wrote it down.
A speech.
And gave it to him and put it on those teleprompters that Republicans used to hate that Obama used. Remember that. And they wrote it and said, here, tell them that they hate socialism and then say you're down for socialism.
Yeah.
It wasn't a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Tell them they hate socialism and then tell them about the gigantic social programs
that
were hard fought by Democratic candidates. Really fast, super fast, just because this segment has mostly been depressing and sad. There was some scary stuff there. So he did tell the crowd, literally, the Democrats want to destroy you and destroy your country. Mm-hmm. They want to destroy you. At this point, why not just go on the stage and say, the Democrats want to murder you and your family? I don't know, it's the same thing.
Kind of do.
Led instantly, a couple minutes in, led chants against the fake news in the back of the room. Said that the Democrats are despicable because they're trying to legally go after their political opponents. Then he said William Barr might have to arrest Hillary Clinton. Promised to cure cancer after his son was on stage mocking Joe Biden for talking about curing cancer. So again, the internal consistency was a little bit light there. But this just gives you a little sampler platter of what this campaign's gonna be like. Spoiler alert, it's gonna be hell.
And lastly, anyway, he also said he was responsible for signing a bill into law that would help with veterans and their healthcare and everything, which in fact it was signed in 2014, because you know President Trump was in office in 2014.
If you can't, that like the fact that he can claim credit for a bill that was passed years before he became president, like let's hit reboot on this whole thing. What are we doing as a society? And if you went to that crowd and you showed them, he said we passed VA choice. They'd been trying to get that passed for 44 years. And then you tell them it was a McCain-Sanders bill that passed under Obama in 2014. They will tell you, no, he passed it. I would say what, 60% of that crowd would say no, he passed it? 70%, 80? We live in crazy times.
What he meant to say was instead of 44 years, he meant by the 44th president.
There you go. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back. Joe Biden's also been talking, so we'll talk about that. Donald Trump loves to talk about how much he loves the police, but his words have not been matched with funds reimbursing them for protecting him at a variety of stops across the country. And joining us now to break down the situation is Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Dave, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hey, John, great to be with you.
Good to have you here. So you had a story just last week about Donald Trump, but not just Donald Trump, not reimbursing the police in different cities. Can you tell us how much are we talking about, where are we talking about, and all of that?
So the bottom line is that Donald Trump has had more than 60 of these rallies, Make America Great Again rallies, ever since he announced for president, which wasn't yesterday in Orlando, but actually the day of his inauguration when he filed paperwork with the Federal Election Commission that allowed him to raise money toward his reelection. So he's been traveling around the country, city to city, trying to raise money, get people excited, doing the rallies that he does. And in the midst of doing so, he has effectively left 10 cities with the bag open. And he'll come to town. And of course, these rallies oftentimes will attract 5, 10, 15,000 people. And if the cities that he's going to don't actually own the facility that Donald Trump is rallying at, they don't have a whole lot of leverage in billing him for all the extreme costs, sometimes five, six figures, for the police protection, the public safety protection at the event that he's staging. So a lot of candidates over the years have paid bills that they receive from cities after the fact. Donald Trump has taken the approach, John, where he does not pay those bills when he receives them. It's about $841,000 when you add it all up among those 10 cities, which include Erie, Pennsylvania, Green Bay, Wisconsin, Mesa, Arizona, and plenty of others.
So that sounds like a lot of money. I mean, it's not really a lot of money if you are the billionaire you say you are, but he's acting as if it's a lot of money. And so I'm curious about a couple things. So do we have instances where he has reimbursed cities for police protection?
We don't have any evidence that he's received a bill and actually paid that bill. What we do have evidence of is he's gone to cities such as Phoenix and Nashville, where, again, the cities own the convention center or the park or the other type of facility that Donald Trump is having the rally at. In those cases, many of them have made him sign a contract in front of the event and saying, hey, look, if you want to use our facility, that's great. You're welcome to come to our town. That'll be wonderful. But by the way, you know, here's $50,000 worth of charges for rent and security and electricity and other costs that you're going to have to pay in order to have the event in our place.
So in the case where there is a written contract, is this actually breaking the law?
So there's no law that says that if Donald Trump or any presidential candidate comes to a city, has an event, requires the city to basically provide a whole lot of public safety and police protection, the law doesn't say that the campaign will ultimately have to pay the bill that the city sends them. So it becomes an issue of really what a candidate stands for. Donald Trump is a candidate who time and time again has said, look, I always support law enforcement. I love the police. I am behind the men and women in blue, hither and yon, and yet these cities, which oftentimes are working on a shoestring budget, might not have a whole lot of population, whole lot of resources. Lebanon, Ohio, for example, city of 20,000 people. Donald Trump, he racked up a police bill that would have run the entire police force in Lebanon, Ohio for two whole days. So it's real money for a small, medium-sized town that's hosting a Make America Great Again rally, but also too left holding the bag after the fact when the Trump campaign isn't paying the bills that those cities send them.
So what about other candidates? You talk a little bit in your article about others who have accrued bills and others talking about whether they would in the future pay.
So we reached out to every Democratic candidate and we asked them the same question. All right, you haven't had big rallies necessarily like Donald Trump has had, but if you do in the course of the campaign, if you have an event that has 10,000 people come to it and a city sends you a bill, what are you going to do? So Elizabeth Warren, for example, Cory Booker, Pete Buttigieg, amongst some of the candidates who told us, if we get a bill, we're going to pay that bill. No questions asked. We had other candidates like Bernie Sanders who didn't give really a straight answer, said, yeah, we'll sign a contract if it's at a city facility, but he didn't speak to the notion of paying a bill that he received after the fact. And in 2016, Bernie Sanders was an interesting case. At first, he didn't pay any of the bills that any city had sent his campaign for police protection, for public safety issues. Ultimately, because of some public pressure, we wrote an article, in fact, his campaign paid almost all of those bills off. So ultimately did give the cities the money that they were asking for. And then we had candidates like Joe Biden when we asked them just most recently here for the 2020 election, who just never got back to us. We called, we emailed many, many times, and they just simply had no answer for us at this point. So we don't know whether Joe Biden, among others, are going to go ahead and pay these bills if they receive them.
And just for the record, I think they should all pay. I understand it's an expense, but considering the amount, especially in a presidential election, that these campaigns are raising, $15,000 here, $20,000 there, it goes to the police, it shows support for this group, they should just pay it. And anyway, thank you so much for your reporting. It's available if people want to take a look at Center for Public Integrity to get a lot more numbers here. Dave, as always, thank you.
Hey, thanks so much, John.
We're gonna take a short break here. We come back more on Joe Biden, not necessarily about police, but about billionaires. He's been talking with them, and we'll break it down after this. Joe Biden is currently engaged in a primary fight against a number of progressive challengers who've made very clear who they're fighting for, on what side of the economic spectrum, who's their policies are intended to benefit. And because he's associated with, you know, past presidents, he's been in office for a long time, senator for a very long time, there's this perception that he is a representative of the way things have been, not the way that things need to be. And so he needs to campaign in a very careful fashion to show that he understands where the country is coming from. And so since if he gets the primary nomination, he's gonna be running against a billionaire. The idea that he would embrace these same people, the economic elites that have gotten their way in American politics for so long, seems pretty ridiculous. And yet this week he was at the Carlyle Hotel in New York and he had this to say to a group of millionaires and billionaires. Remember, I got in trouble with some of the people on my team on the Democratic side because I said, you know, what I've found is rich people are just as patriotic as poor people, not a joke. I mean, we may not want to demonize anybody who's made money. And he goes on to say, truth of the matter is, you all know in your gut what has to be done. We can disagree in the margins, but the truth of the matter is, it's all within our wheelhouse and nobody has to be punished. No one's standard of living would change. Nothing would fundamentally change. If I were Joe Biden, I would not say the quote, nothing would fundamentally change. In a time when many, many people think that a lot needs to fundamentally change in this country.
There's also nobody has to be punished. So again, we talk a lot about how Democrats speak on the playing field of what Republicans use. Their terminology, the things that they think are important. So, I mean, say like the pro-life movement. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's more anti-choice. You know, it's pro-life versus pro-choice. It's anti-choice is what you are. So there's connotations to the way things are said. So when you say no one has to be punished, it means that anyone else who wants to have fairness in our society means they're punishing rich people. They're not being punished. Mm-hmm. Poor people are being punished, but when rich folks talk about taking tax breaks and then throwing it on the backs of working class people, the conversation isn't, why are you punishing the working class? Mm-hmm. The conversation is we're helping the rich so they can help everyone else. Mm-hmm. It's positive terms all around. So when you're speaking against something like this, you're still playing on their terms of we don't want to punish anybody. Mm-hmm. You sound like a Republican.
Yeah, and look, the thing is, I don't know who the individual wealthy people in the room were. They're probably lovely people. I don't have any particular beef with any individual in that room. But I do have a problem with the way that historically, since the beginning of the United States, but it's been very clear in the past 50 years, the economic elite have been able to, thanks to campaign finance regulations that are incredibly lax and growing more lax with every passing year, able to take their money and change the laws so that they can get more and more money. And along the way, that would be fine if it wasn't also making it more difficult for us to own homes, pay for college, start a business, not die if we get in some sort of medical emergency, but that's the way it is. We do need fundamental change. So don't say nothing would fundamentally change. The part of his statement that I agree with is that even with fundamental changes, and I will use Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax as an example. This is a wealth tax of like 2% on wealth above $50 million mm-hmm. that would fund a lot of great programs that would benefit the poor and working class and middle class in America. But as Joe Biden said, no one's standard of living would change. Well, there'd be a benefit on the bottom end. But for those wealthy who were affected even by the wealth tax, one of the most radical policies that a Democratic presidential candidate has proposed in recent years, their standard of living would be exactly the same. They would lose 2% of their wealth. And they would still be able to own multiple mansions, multiple luxury cars. They'd have their yachts with yachts inside of them. That would not have to fundamentally change. But what would change is that everyone else would have a chance at the American dream that they've been told about for so long, but has been growing more and more distant.
Isn't it weird that a minimum wage hike of a few dollars, $5 maybe, for the poor and working class is so drastic, but we're talking about how we're gonna be punishing and destroying billionaires' lives from them having to pay into the system that they've benefited from. We keep leaving that part out. They're not just paying because, oh man, we're so mad at them. They're paying because we've paid for them. Mm-hmm. The reason they have the position they're in is because they've done it off the backs of other people. It's never pointed out because we're gonna hurt their feelings.
Yeah.
But we don't worry about hurting folks' feelings, as you said, that are just looking to live. If they're gonna have a baby, because you guys are concerned about everyone having babies, mm-hmm. how much that's gonna cost a normal person.
Yeah.
We're not concerned about those things, but if a 2% tax on people who have more money than they can even find, that they won't miss, but by the way, they'll like to add it onto the pile, somehow that's a big deal.
Yeah. And so I don't like, it's not so much just the quotes, although I don't like the quotes, it's what it represents. What would he actually do if he were president? What would he challenge? Who would he challenge? Who would he not challenge? And it seems like he's letting us know. That's the unfortunate thing.
That radical platform of no fundamental change. Even, I mean, you know, Republicans never run on no change. Yeah. They constantly run on, we're gonna take it back to where it used to be. We're gonna take, I've said it so many times, your president in office right now started his old campaign by saying, we're gonna shut it all down. Mm-hmm. Those black and brown people can't stand them. We're gonna make sure this never happens again.
Yeah, no one is going to be voting for the candidate who tells you better things aren't possible. That's just the way it is. So let's turn now to campaigning, actually. Joe Biden, over the past 24 hours, has had two very classic Joe Biden type gaffes. And the reason I want to talk about this is that when he was initially presumed, like, if he runs, he's definitely going to have it, and he's doing really well in the polls, that's true. But we keep saying there's a reason he didn't win the other times that he ran for the presidency, despite, you know, his Rust Belt credentials or rides the train or whatever you want to say, Uncle Joe, all that stuff. It's because he's not a good campaigner. He says ridiculous things, he gets himself in lots of trouble. And so we got two for you. First is the one that's not so bad once you hear the second. It was when he was speaking with a bunch of extremely wealthy people in New York, and he said, you're not the other, I need you very badly. If you're trying to win a Democratic primary, don't go to a group of really rich people in New York and say, I need you very badly. Say that to real working Americans. But that's the not so bad one. The bad one was, and this is by Edward Isaac Dover was tweeting this, tonight at that fundraiser, he recalled serving with a major segregationist Mississippi senator, saying, I was in a caucus with James O. Eastland. He never called me boy, he always called me son. He imitated a southern drawl and said, at least there was some civility, we got things done. That was one of two segregationists that he talked about the great relationship he had with them as an example of how bipartisanship and civility are possible. We can work together even if we appear to disagree.
Did you ever call him boy? Did you ever call him son? Did you ever pat him on his head? I feel like he may go, take your hands off my damn head. Because people in those certain positions don't deal with disrespect, but they expect other folks to. And hey, as long as he's being nice to me, again, we're playing on their field. Because you have to demand that respect. And when people start doing it like we are now, they don't like it.
Yeah, and like if it seems like, oh, you're just trying to tie him to someone kind of bad or whatever. Joe Biden knew him. Worked with him for years and years and years. So I have to assume he's familiar with some of who this guy James Eastland has said. We're gonna bring up a couple quotes. I don't even know how much of this we can show you unblurred, but let's take a look at this. To give you an idea of who this person was, I don't wanna read any of it, but the guy referred to black people in Montgomery as slimy, juicy, unbearably stinking racial slur, African flesh eaters. He said that whites should use guns, bows and arrows, slingshots and knives in pursuit of racial slurs that I won't say. The worst, most violent racist rhetoric. According to Jamel Smith, writer for Rolling Stone, Eastland was known as the voice of the white South. He opposed the Civil Rights Act, complained of mongrelization, and spoke of black people as an inferior race. Jamel says he may have liked you, Joe Biden. He still voted to undermine our humanity. You just disproved your whole point.
I want you to think about that last quote from, I mean, not quotes, but those things that Eastland had said in the past, right? And we're not supposed to take offense, but we're supposed to have this positive reaction to Joe Biden working with someone like this. But we'll quickly forget that 3 years ago, 4 years ago, enough Americans were deathly offended that a large group of black folks said, Black Lives Matter. That was offensive, but not all this. Yeah. Not mongrels, not shooting bows and arrows and guns and African flesh eaters. None of that is offensive. Let's work with those people. But if there's someone that's elected office, it's a black person that said Black Lives Matter, and a conservative says, hey, I worked with the guy that said Black Lives Matter, he will get his ass kicked out of office so fast, your head will spin. Just saying, it's how it works. The respect only goes one direction, and it'll continue to go that direction until you demand it.
Yeah. Yeah, so just awful. And you could read more about Eastland and about Talmadge, the other segregationist senator that he talked about, like his great working relationship with. Dude, Joe Biden, you're white. That's why you had a great working relationship with them. That's why they were able to bridge the gap and work with you. Not so with other people. You know, when they were fighting against the civil rights movement, when they were fighting against Brown v. Board of Education, that's the sort of people we're talking about. Joe Biden, man. And honestly, at this point, like, we're so early in the campaign. Do you really think this is going to stop? You think this train of gaffes is going to end? I kind of doubt it.
Not even gaffes at this point.
That's true, too. Yeah. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little bit of fun to close out the hour. It's primary season, and that means that the atmospheric concentration of pandering is spiking quickly. The New York Times recently asked a bunch of questions to all of the different candidates, and some of it's good stuff. You should look it up. It's, you know, about different policies and everything. But some are sort of general questions where you get to just answer about the sort of person you are. And some of the candidates were unable to resist the urge to pander to the audience. So, JR, I'm going to show you a few responses on a particular question. I want to see.
I haven't looked.
If you don't look at it, I want to see if you can identify the pattern. So asked, who is your hero and why? John Delaney said his personal hero is his wife. His political hero is Abraham Lincoln. Both of those seem like fine answers.
Yeah.
The same question to Seth Moulton. He said his personal hero is his wife. His political hero is John F. Kennedy. Okay, John F. Kennedy, great president.
We're trending.
Taken before his time. Jay Inslee said his personal hero is his wife. His political hero is the American voter. Beto O'Rourke says his personal hero is his wife, kids, and family. Political hero, Abraham Lincoln. Steve Bullock, mixing it up, said his personal hero is his wife. Political hero, Joe Mazurek, who I checked. I don't know who that is. I'm fairly sure Joe Mazurek doesn't know who that is. But anyway, no, that's a fine answer. But yes, okay. How many wives? They've got some great wives up in here.
What's really going to happen is if once Kamala gets asked the question, it's fair to say, my wife. And everyone goes, oh my gosh, she's breaking news.
I think she said mom or grandma. So there, look, there were people who did not go in that
Someone's
direction.
Someone's wife.
The women gave much more varied answers. I don't think any of them said husband, actually. And I think Julian Castro, I think, said grandmother. So there were those who diverged. But all of these, it's like, come on.
I wonder if you're a front if you're a front runner for president, say I'm running for president and I'm winning. I'm way ahead. And then people are like, oh yeah, who's your political hero, Mr. Jackson? I'm like, you know what? Or who's your hero? Mm-hmm. Like, you know what? I've always liked Iron Man.
That's you know what I said earlier today, actually. That's actually what I said.
And right now, my wife and I are having a bit of trouble right now. I don't really like her that much. So not her. No, she's real mean. Mm-hmm. Like, what if you said that? Would you suddenly drop in the polls? What is it about?
Well, I wouldn't say that I don't like her. But if Yang had answered Iron Man, would anyone see that and think, I don't like that, not supporting him?
It would stand out.
Yes.
It means he's a little fun and he's being honest. Like, man, this guy actually likes Marvel things.
Yeah.
Maybe he's a bit of a nerd. Maybe he used to dress up like Iron Man as a kid. These are things that give you layers.
Yeah.
The rest of this just has you sit on the same plane as everyone else. If not, lie and say something else. Why not?
Yeah, like saying it's your wife, I'm sure you love your wife. Maybe she is your hero, but that's not why you're saying it here. You're saying it here because you want to seem like you appreciate women, which is fine, I guess, but it may be even worse is Beto O'Rourke saying his kids are his hero. You love your kids. Your kids aren't your hero, I don't think. What did they did that was so heroic, okay? They cleaned up the toys. Come on, they're not heroes.
That one time when he was a baby and he took a dump everywhere and it didn't land on me. Hero.
Hero. He did it not on the carpet, he did it on the tile. That day he was a true hero. But anyway, yeah, just be real people. Be real people.
It's so much easier. It's harder work to do it this way. I've always said it. You know what? Doing this takes a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
Doing this is really, it's like simple and it's your way of doing things. If you go out and work, you like putting a t-shirt on, that's cool. Rolling up your sleeves and acting like you're wearing a still collar shirt, that's more work.
Yeah, yeah.
Just be
natural.
You know
what people like? People like people, real people. Anyway, maybe campaign is one. Okay, really fast, Lotto Islet, thank you for your iTunes review that said, John and Brooke are the dream team, what a great show. We appreciate that. You've gotten
before
a lot of comments.
It must have been before JR Wednesday came on.
It was actually. Anyway, thank you for coming on JR Wednesday. And thank you for watching, everybody. We got a couple more days left in the week. We will see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.